Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. 22 regional experts take on the challenge of defining and exploring the interior borderlands in a new book by the same title. Where does the Midwest fade and the Great Plains begin? Is the West a geographic distinction or a cultural one? How does where we live define who we are? The book was honored this month at the Midwest Book Awards as one of the region's best. Today, we welcome the book's editor and publisher. John Lauck is the founding president of the Midwestern History Association. He's an associate editor of Middle West Review and an adjunct professor of history and political science at the University of South Dakota. And he is the editor of the Interior Borderlands, Regional Identity in the Midwest and Great Plains. John, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Harry Thompson, Executive Director of the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University, and he's editor of A New South Dakota History. He's published more than 60 books for the Center for Western Studies. Harry, welcome back. Thank you.
Glad to be here, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about the Midwest Book Awards, and congratulations, because there was some pretty stiff competition in this category. Put it in context for what this award might mean.
Well, it was stiff competition. I think there were 13 books nominated for it and in the running, and some of them were fairly prominent, and I was a little surprised when we defeated some of them, but I heard from people at the Book Awards that the reviewers were very impressed with the number of different perspectives we were able to gather on this particular question: where does the Midwest end and where does the Great Plains begin? And I think they thought it was a fresh look and something they hadn't read before. So it made an impression on them, and we're still celebrating, Harry and I. We've been doing a victory lap here for a week. It's been very fun, and we're glad all the work paid off.
Center for Western Studies is a small press. We put out about one book every year, 12 months to 18 months. So to be so honored is definitely something that we appreciate very much.
Harry, tell me a little bit about the history of the Center for Western Studies publishing program, because it's pretty significant in the region and stands out for the work that it's done over the years.
Well, those are very nice comments, Lori. I appreciate those. The Center has been publishing books since 1978, so about 42 years. And a total would be about 80 books altogether on a variety of subjects: the geography of South Dakota, the history of South Dakota, the history of the farmers, South Dakota Farmers Union, a book about sun dancing at Pine Ridge, Rosebud and Pine Ridge, was one of our very first publications. And in fact, in that very first year, we brought out a book called Where the West Begins, which is kind of an interesting take on the topic today that we're having here on the radio.
Who were, Harry, some of those early people for the Center for Western Studies who laid the groundwork that you're still expanding on today?
Right. Well, the founder of the center is Herbert Krause. He was the writer in residence here at Augustana for many years. He passed away in 1976, but in the middle 1960s. 1964 is the year that we usually associate with the creation of the idea of the Center for Western Studies. He wanted to write grant requests and find funds to do his own research as a writer. He was a novelist, he was a poet, and later he became an essayist. And one of the earliest grants to be received by the Center for Western Studies was a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to fund a project called Changing Social Patterns on the Lingering Frontier. So Krause's work early on set the stage. And then in 1970, as Augustana was looking at the future of small private colleges, the Danforth Foundation down in St. Louis funded a two-year project to look at what might a small private college consider its future to be. And the faculty and the administration at that time felt that the West really was a concept that they wanted to pursue and recognized that Sioux Falls and Augustana are right here on the edge of the West. And so the Board of Trustees officially established the Center for Western Studies and appointed Krauss as the director. So other people at that time would have been Art Huzebo, who later became the director of the center, Tom Killian, a great exponent of the of this part of the country, and many others.
John Locke, this particular book you mentioned, you know, it being a fresh look and a different perspective, and you've been on the program before really talking about this, you know, almost underexplored area of the world, this region that maybe not enough history has been done on, and at the risk of repeating some of the things we've talked about before for new listeners, tell us a little bit about the importance of regional history and books like this, and then we'll get into the specifics of this title.
Well, absolutely. I do want to say real quickly that the Center for Western Studies does so many important things, and we've talked about the books here this morning that Harry's led to publication, but they also have many exhibits and many programs, and you should know, your listeners might be interested, there's a new exhibit at the Center for Western Studies now of old photographs, probably 120 years old, from Crow Creek Indian Reservation that were in the Blue Cloud Abbey collection that are now at the Center for Western Studies archives. But they're fascinating and very much worth seeing, and that's kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of the various exhibits the center has there at Augustana. Also, I want people to know that the old Dakota Conference that started in Madison, my hometown, back in the 70s by Herb Blakely and Ernie Teagarden, et cetera, professors at Dakota State, now is hosted by Augustana University every spring at the Center for Western Studies. And if you want to get into South Dakota history and regional history, that's a great place to begin. Also, public radio listeners might surely know the poet Patrick Hicks, who's now the who is sort of a successor to Herbert Krauss. He's now the writer in residence at Augustana University. So the string continues with Patrick in terms of work on the region and work on literary topics. But yeah, all this
and as a hey John.
Yeah.
John, I should add before we go off the topic of Patrick Hicks, he's the one who introduced me to Herbert Krauss. And I graduated from Augustana College some years ago and had never heard of him. So Patrick is definitely doing his work, even for people who have already graduated from the university. But he showed me some books and some rare titles and told me a little bit about this man, which is a fascinating story.
Well, that's great. I mean, Patrick Hicks is a Minnesotan, and I think in recent years, you know, his novels and his poetry is what he's best known for. But I think in recent years, he's paying more attention to the region and what it means to come from Minnesota and what it means to live in South Dakota. And I think he took a lot of that from Herbert Krauss and revisiting who his, you know, who originally held the position of writer in residence at Augustana. And Herbert Krauss was an advocate of regional history. That was your question, Lori. And thinking about regions, he was from Western Minnesota. He ended up going down to the University of Iowa and getting his PhD there at a time when Wallace Stegner and other regionalist writers and thinkers were very active. And they were part of a group that made the point that we can't allow our culture to be totally nationalized and homogenized, and we need to pay attention to our regional, cultural, and historical traditions. And, you know, that's hard to do in the age of the internet and the age of Twitter. I mean, Krauss and his fellow regionalists were complaining about this back in the 40s and 50s. They had no idea what was coming. But there is some good news. I mean, back in Krauss's day, there really was a mass media that was hard to break into in terms of television and radio, et cetera. But now people have more tools. They have Facebook, and they have local and city groups online that they can be a part of. And someone just sent me an amazing map of Lake Campeska yesterday, and it was all put together by people in the Watertown area who are interested in their history, and they circulated it to the people in that area who care about it. So it's a way, I think there is some good news with the internet. There can be a revival of interest in regional studies driven by people and not just professors.
Yeah. Harry Thompson, in your preface, as we're talking about authors like Herbert Krauss, you also have quotations from Fred Manfred and others. Tell us a little bit about, as you wrote the preface for this, which I just think is a beautiful piece of writing, by the way, to read through. How did you sort of start setting up this idea for people that says, why this is a conversation we've been talking about for a long time, and it still really matters, and here's why?
Yeah, it's a great conundrum, and conundrums are wonderful things to talk about, but they cause you to dig deep into your own inclinations and your own preferred ways of looking at things, and then but at the same time, it kind of opens you up to the opposite point of view or a challenging perspective that someone else might have. When I taught a course called Finding the Great Plains, I would ask the students, so where do you think you are? You know, where are you here in this classroom here at Augustana? And they would look at me, you know, of course, as though something was wrong, because they had a sense of where they were, and why would I even ask this question? So then I'd ask them to raise their hands. I'd say, how many of you think that you're here in the Midwest? And several of them would raise their hand. Then I would say, how many of you think you're in the West? And very few would raise their hands. And then I'd say, so are we on the Great Plains? Do you think we're on the Great Plains? Yes, almost everybody thought they were on the Great Plains. So I would say, is the Great Plains as a region in the Midwest or the West? And, of course, you know, no one really could deal with that, because it's an interesting question. It's again, it's this conundrum. And so, in fact, somebody just stopped in the gallery yesterday and had read the book and said, well, he said, I concluded that there's no solution to the question of where does the Midwest end and the Great Plains begin. And I said, that's the point. That is exactly the point. You have it. So it is a bit of a game. And if we didn't have these kinds of games, as I do say in my preface, you know, where would we be as authors and scholars and book publishers? You know, we have to have something to talk about and write about and research and be concerned about. And it is, as John just said, it is a topic that everybody is concerned about. You know, you don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be a book publisher or an author to be concerned about where you are, although it may not be the topic that is the, you know, overwhelming of concern today.
John Locke, you wrote the introduction for this, as well as being the editor. You wanted to add to what Harry said? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, maybe I'm a little bit more old-fashioned here, but I do say in there what I kind of think the dividing line is.
That's where I was going. And so I'll ask it like this, and that's that you prefer this term of center line. And when you answer this question, I want you to think, if you would, that you're on the radio, but that many people are tuned in their cars right now and they're driving across the state, maybe for the first time. So when you describe this, where is the Midwest? Where is the Great Plains? Where is this center line? Where do you fold the map? Give us a sort of a visual tour as well, as you tell us about your thoughts on where we are at.
Well, I think it's worth trying to come up with an answer, and I think we can get pretty close. If you visualize, since we're talking on South Dakota Public Radio, let's focus on South Dakota for a moment. Everyone has, I think, a working understanding of East River versus West River. And I think that's kind of a stand-in for this question of where does the Midwest end and the Great Plains begin? Once you cross the Missouri River, I think it's definitely true that you sense you're in a different place. You can see that the topography has changed. You can see that the land around you doesn't get as much rain. It's a little more brown than it was 200 miles back, where it was more green. There were fewer trees. There are more ranches and more cattle and more Indian reservations and more evergreens and mountains, et cetera. So it's different. Now, if we really want to get precise, I think you could say right around the 98th meridian is where the dividing point is. And the Missouri River for South Dakotans is right around the 100th meridian. So if you just back off there, back east, 50 miles, 100 miles or so, that's when you can, if you're paying attention and not just, staring into blank space and getting lost in your podcast, if you pay attention, you can begin to see the changes. But they definitely happen around the river. And I think, South Dakotans who have been here a long time, they recognize this. Lori, I want to go back to one quick thing about Fred Manfred, too. We talked about him briefly. Frederick Manfred was very much interested in these questions of regional identity. And, of course, your listeners should know that he is the author of Lord Grizzly, which Leonardo DiCaprio made into a movie a few years ago called The Revenant. But Fred Manfred had this idea of what he called Siouxland, which is the very, very specific region of eastern South Dakota, southwestern Minnesota, northwestern Iowa, and northeastern Nebraska. This area that is essentially the Big Sioux River Valley, which he called Siouxland. Well, when we presented this book at the Western History Association last fall, Harry and I were there. I'm sorry, I said Henry, that's my son. But Harry and I were there, and we were talking about this book, and Bill Cronin, the great environmental historian, came, and he said, "This is a wonderful book. I really like this idea, but the next big wave in environmental history is going to be studies of rivers." And Harry and I kind of looked at each other and smiled, because our next project is going to be a study of the Big Sioux River Valley, or this region that Frederick Manfred called Siouxland, and which, Lori, you're sitting right in the middle of. Your studios in downtown Sioux Falls are right on the Big Sioux River, right where the river bends north. That is the Big Sioux River Valley, which people drive around all the time, but they don't really know what it is. So with this new project, Harry and I are going to try and give it a little bit more texture and definition and help people to understand this place a little better.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Fred Manfred, and straight from Harry's preface, where he talks about how Manfred ascribed characteristics to people he called Siouxlanders. And I'll just read here where he says, they are culturally uniform, speak with a distinctive accent, broad, full-toned, and very clear, exhibit a special kind of morality, valuing honesty, fair play, spirited competition, and individual freedom, follow our own kind of justice, characterized by compassion for those less fortunate, and are intolerant of greed and arrogance. People not from this region, Manfred called outlanders. And Harry, I want to use this as a jumping off point to talk about how the place that we're from can also be a cultural distinction or can help identify the kind of people that we are.
Yeah, well, you know, I really appreciate, and as you point out, I quote that passage from Manfred, and I knew Fred, and you know, he very much embodied the characteristics of this part of the country. He was a vocal advocate for the identity and the importance of being associated with, as John just pointed out, Siouxland. You know, that was his name. Now, we see the word Siouxland on commercial vehicles and buildings and things like that, particularly down towards Sioux City. But Manfred is the one who came up with that idea. And in doing so, he was pointing out the fact that this is the land of the Sioux, that the indigenous people who lived here before white settlement should always be in our mind. And in his series of buckskin tales that he wrote, similar to Cooper's Leatherstocking tales, he begins with books about Native Americans. And, you know, certainly one of his most celebrated novels is Scarlet Plume, which is about the 1862 Dakota, U.S. Dakota War. So, you know, what this characteristic, this sense of accomplishment, achievement, purposefulness that Manfred himself, certain independence, self-reliance that Manfred himself exhibited, he associated with people from this part of the country.
Yeah. And John, as I was kind of drawn in this book to some of the literary interpretations, especially one of my favorite chapters so far, and I haven't read every chapter, is Chapter 9 by a professor from Minnesota State University, which explores the Midwest and the Great Plains, Borderlands, and modern women's memoir. And it was fascinating to see her talk about women writing from the Midwest, about their deep roots and their connectivity to place and people on the Great Plains, women on the Great Plains, having a different perspective on how they define their geography. But in your introduction, you also talk, and you know, John Miller was passionate about this, and I never got to have him on the show to talk about this Carolyn Fraser book and Laura Ingalls Wilder and sort of some of this mythology or some of the stories that we tell ourselves about the people who came here trying to make a life. Will you start with the Ingalls family a little bit and some of the things that, you know, John and yourself, you know, had some questions about how she portrayed some of those people? And I'm asking you this question because, of course, it's going to speak to this broader idea of how we are seen from people from elsewhere.
Well, I should say that when we had our first conference panel that led to this book at the Center for Western Studies, John Miller was on it, our beloved John Miller, the great historian of South Dakota who just passed away. And he would love to be a part of this conversation. And I think his last published article was a cover story in the journal Middle West Review, which is a journal based at the University of South Dakota. And it was an article exploring this book by Carolyn Fraser about the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, as you mentioned, Laurie. And John strongly objected to this book, and he was not happy that it won the Pulitzer Prize because there were major mistakes in it. And one of the things that Carolyn Fraser emphasizes in her work is how terrible Laura thought her life was out here on the prairie. And as an expert on Laura, John thoroughly demonstrated that Laura was not unhappy. And this is all kind of a myth invented by Carolyn Frazier because it makes the story seem a little bit more dramatic, and it makes it seem like she's really pulling back the curtain on what was really going on with Laura. And John very convincingly demonstrates that's not true. Now, I totally agree with John on this point about Laura. He's right and Carolyn Frazier is wrong. But generally speaking, women who were usually told they're going to move out to the Great Plains, they were not big fans of this. They tended to prefer to live in Wisconsin and places like Michigan, where there were a lot more trees and things were more green and their families were there. So all of these women's historians who have studied the westward movement, they have chronicled, you know, the complaints of women who ended up out on the Dakota prairies, which were a little more rough. And that chapter by Rachel Hanel that you mentioned, she explores this theme in literature and how women's experiences tended to be better in the Midwest than they were in the Great Plains. And this helps form this cultural boundary or these cultural distinctions between the two regions and explains how the experiences are different between the two regions. And so that's why Rachel's chapter was so great.
Yeah, and there was a sense that I had never considered before that I got from Rachel. I don't know that she said this overtly, but, well, if you're going to live there, you got to carry a lot more water. You have a lot less time for, you know, the life of, it wasn't just that these women were spoiled or unprepared or somehow, you know, faint of heart. It was that their time, you know, like we see in other countries, was largely going to be spent on things other than education and other forms of self-development. It was going to be on some very basic survival activities. And I thought that was a fascinating look at that. And John, yeah, expand that, if you will, to this idea that, you know, of flyover country, of, you know, this is a place where people were sort of duped into coming. They were here accidentally. They didn't know what they were getting into once they crossed, you know, the river and tried to, you know, make a life in the Great Plains. There's more to the story than that. Why do historians or people from other areas tend to try to reduce that to a very simplified tale?
Well, you mentioned water, and we should have brought this up earlier. I mean, the key dividing line between the Midwest and the Plains, you know, just for simplicity's sake, is the 100th meridian, so declared by John Wesley Powell 150 years ago. And he chose that line because that's the line you cross where you get 20 inches of rain or less. And this speaks to this point about farm women who had to spend so much time finding water to survive and going to the well and hauling water to the house. Whereas if you live back in Wisconsin, there's water all around you. It's not a problem. But once you cross this line out here, things get a lot tougher. And that's why this is a place where they would put up windmills and try and pump water out of the ground. And it's just a different way of farming and existing. But, you know, these are the kind of distinctions that get lost if you're a person who observes these things from the coast, if you observe them at all. And, you know, there's the famous Saul Steinberg cartoon that ran in the New Yorker in the 1970s, you may recall this, which is a New Yorker's view of the United States. And outside the office in Manhattan, of course, everything is very detailed. Every nook and cranny of the street corner, they understand. But out in the West is just kind of this blank space. And in the middle is the term written Nebraska Plains or something. And, you know, they just don't know. And, you know, we can't blame them for that. They're from different parts of the country. They're focused on their own regions, et cetera. But this is why we must have our own voices and publish our own books and support our own institutions like the Center for Western Studies, because the people on the coast aren't going to do it for us.
Yeah. There's a new movie on Netflix now by Jon Stewart where some political operatives go to Wisconsin, and it begins with the phrase, you know, rural America, as he heads to this town, because it's just all one vast spot to this Democratic political, political operative. It's just rural America, and I'm heading there. I know nothing about it. This broad statement. Harry, some of the other highlights from the book for people who want to read it. That was one of my favorite chapters. I also really liked this chapter from Michael Mullen. What stands out to you, Harry, in the book that people maybe we haven't had time to touch on today that people can stop by the Center for Western Studies and pick up a copy they might be interested in?
Well, it is a smorgasbord of wonderful perspectives. One that I think is very unique is Debbie Hansen's discussion of community cookbooks. And yeah. I know that when this was originally submitted, John and I wondered, what direction would this go in? But Debbie teaches English here at Augustana, and it's a shorter chapter, and it will change the way you look at your cookbooks that you might have in your kitchen, because she as a scholar, she and social popular history and popular literature scholar, she pulls out of the cookbook phenomenon some wonderful conclusions. So I would recommend people look at that. Brad Tennant from Presentation College does a wonderful job with the 100th Meridian that John Lauck has just mentioned. And I would say, for example, that the John Wesley Powell's decision that the 100th meridian is where it all changes was certainly more correct, perhaps, at the time that he was doing his surveying and researching. But as the drought that now has become quite prevalent in the West, and we see it with the fires, and again, here we are with the fires in the Tonto National Forest in Arizona starting up again yet this season, and who knows what's going to happen in California. But the dryness is moving to the east. So that 100th meridian is approaching, in terms of the distinction that it holds between the West and the Midwest, is approaching the 98th. And again, the 98th is where we are here in Sioux Falls. It is the mark that I feel most comfortable with in terms of a boundary line. And I believe that the Big Sioux River Valley is where the West begins. It really is. By the time you get to the Missouri River, you're in the West. And this is what John Lauck is saying. Things change, and if you're not watching as you drive west, you are already there before you realize it. Certainly there's nothing like going down the interstate and on across the Missouri River and then heading up again, and that elevation and that sense of rise that you get from that part of the state is unique, but you're already in the West by the time you get there. So, but it starts over here on the 98th meridian, which is unfortunately, in terms of dryness, becoming aridity, which is a topic that many of the writers in this collection talk about, is a serious concern.
John Lauck, our time is running short. Harry mentioned English professor Debbie Hansen, and I thought that chapter that I mentioned of Michael Mullins talking about how different people from different disciplines see the Midwest and the Great Plains, and there was a difference between how geographers or how historians and how English professors saw the Great Plains. What do you want to leave us with this today in our remaining 2 minutes or so, John?
Well, one thing you asked Harry about some of the chapters that we should flag for people that might interest them. One thing I really enjoyed about the book was the contribution by Gleaves Whitney, who's at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. And he muses on the old saying by Gertrude Stein that there is no there there, which was her phrase to describe her hometown of Oakland, California. But as Gleaves points out, this phrase has been very widely misunderstood. She was not saying there's nothing out there in flyover country and the boring West and you should stay away because it's not interesting. She was saying that her old there, meaning her family and the neighborhood where she grew up, that was gone due to development and out-migration. She wasn't saying this is a boring, blank, empty space that should be ignored. She was saying that her old roots were gone. And at the same time, she was defending her roots and the importance of roots and understanding your heritage and where you come from. So I really appreciated Gleaves' essay about that.
The book is called The Interior Borderlands, Regional Identity in the Midwest and Great Plains. You can find it at the Center for Western Studies. John Lauck is founding president of the Midwestern History Association, an editor, and Harry Thompson is executive director for the Center for Western Studies. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Lori. It's been a pleasure.